Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Paul Waldman about the Republican effort to do tax reform, or so-called tax reform, and why they have a good chance of screwing this one up, too. Paul, of course, writes for The Washington Post, The American Prospect, and The Week. Then we'll be joined by journalist Ben Adler, who argues that despite Trump's desire to undo all of the progress we've made on tackling greenhouse gas emissions, it's not clear that he can actually derail that train. It's not clear he can succeed in that effort. Ben wrote this piece for The Washington Post. Finally, and sticking with climate, we'll be joined by Kendra Pierre-Lewis. She's a staff writer at Popular Science, and she's going to tell us about a new study looking at where people displaced by rising sea levels might go, where those people might go, and the potential problems they might bring with them from low-lying coastal areas. It's a big show, and we don't have too much time for the usual introductory nonsense. I will just note that The Intercept reported this week that the Republicans are selling access to congressional staffers. Deep-pocketed donors can donate like $5,000 and get a chit-chat with staff. Of course, it's not unusual to sell access to members of Congress, but it is unprecedented with staffers. We've never seen this before. And the staff are often people who know more than their principals and do the hard work of writing legislation. In some ways, it's better to have the staff working on your behalf than the principal. Remember, it was the party of corruption theme that propelled Democrats to two big elections in 2006 and 2008. I think that we're going to see that coming out again loud and clear. There is talk of the GOP resurrecting their efforts to repeal and replace the ACA. I wouldn't expect much from this because the same dynamics are still in place. You get a bill that's cruel enough for the hardliners. It polls terribly. And Republicans in more swingy districts freak out and look out for their own chances of re-election. But it looks like this effort will produce a bill that's even worse than the last one in terms of the substantive policy. But the thing I want to note is that, according to several reports, this new move is being driven by a desire to get Donald Trump something that he can call a win in his first 100 days in office. So if you think about it, they will screw over, they're happy to screw over, like, cancer patients and pregnant women to give a historically unpopular president something to brag about within some arbitrary time period, right? The first 100 days doesn't actually mean anything. It's just a thing, a media thing. It's actually kind of impressively craven. And another example why I shouldn't let people who hate the idea of government run it. Well, it seems obvious. You wouldn't let a mechanic who hates cars work on your car. Anyway, we'll take a quick break and then be right back with Paul Waldman. Stay tuned.
And now, please rise for our opening hymn. In the Garden of Eden by I, Ron Butterfly.
In the Garden of Eden, honey, don't you know that I love you? In the Garden of Eden, baby, don't you know that I'll always be true?
Hey, Mort, remember when we used to make out to this hymn?
Wait a minute, this sounds like rock and or roll. I know one of you is responsible for this.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm always happy to welcome Paul Waldman to the show. Paul writes for the Washington Post's Plumline. He is also a columnist for The Week and The American Prospect. He's a busy, busy guy. Paul, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you.
So they are supposedly moving on to tax reform, although they keep trying to resurrect the effort to repeal Obamacare. You've written a couple of pieces about how tax reform isn't going to be easy, and probably for reasons that are similar to why they can't get it together on healthcare. Before we get into that, a number of reports have suggested that these two efforts are linked, that cutting Obamacare was the prerequisite to tax reform because it would free up space to cut taxes without driving up the deficit. It seems that's a common misperception, though. What is the deal?
Yeah, it's a little confusing because there are a lot of people who are saying contradictory things on this. The idea was that if you could repeal the ACA first and all of its taxes, then you'd have kind of a lower, you start with a lower tax base, a baseline, and then when you went to cut taxes in your tax reform bill, you'd only have to raise enough revenue to meet that lower baseline. In order, and this is the key, in order to get your bill to be able to pass through reconciliation. Now, the key with reconciliation is that you're not allowed to pass it with reconciliation unless your bill will not increase the deficit beyond a 10-year budget window. So you can pass something through reconciliation that increases the deficit, but it'll only last for 10 years. So people might remember that the Bush tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, they sunsetted, they ended after 10 years. And that's because the Republicans wanted to pass them through reconciliation, which only requires 50 votes. But they wanted to increase the deficit because they were giving away these big tax breaks. So the Republicans would prefer to have whatever tax cuts they pass be permanent. But the trouble with this analysis is that there's a logical problem, which is that the bill itself, the tax reform bill, has to meet that requirement. I'm sorry, my dog's barking.
Right.
So anyway, the trouble is that the bill has to meet that requirement kind of on its own terms. If you're going to do something like eliminate the inheritance tax, because, you know, it's important that Eric and Donnie Jr. don't have to pay taxes when they get their inheritance, that's going to increase the deficit. And what you did on a previous bill doesn't really make a difference. So when I checked in with some budget experts,
it's okay. Usually it's my dogs barking. They're being quiet today. I'm really happy that it's your dogs.
The entire tax system doesn't really matter. What matters is, does this bill, in its provisions, some of which may raise revenue, some of which may decrease revenue, does it come out positive or negative? And if it comes out with increasing the deficit beyond those 10 years, then you can't pass it through reconciliation. Now, if they're going to pass a tax bill, they're going to have to do it through reconciliation if it's going to do the things that they want, because Democrats aren't going to support it. And right now, the Senate is divided 52-48 in Republicans' favor. They're not going to get to the 60 votes they need to overcome a filibuster. So if they're going to do tax reform, they have to do it through reconciliation. And I think that in the end, it's going to come down to a choice for them of, do we come up with some tax bill that doesn't really do what we want with all the kinds of tax breaks that we want for the wealthy and for corporations, but that might be able to get enough Democratic support to get us to 60 votes? Or do we pass a tax bill that gives us all the goodies that we want, but that we're going to have to say will expire in 10 years? And I think that when faced with that choice, they'll do what Republicans did in 2001 and 2003, which is that they'll write it with a sunset after 10 years, in the hope that when those 10 years are over, there'll be a new Congress that will extend it. And it's better to get the things you really want for 10 years than to get something you don't really want, even if it's permanent.
All right. And I just note that 82% of Bush's so-called temporary tax cuts were in fact made permanent during various contrived fiscal crises, these fiscal cliff budget deals, and that once a tax is cut temporarily, the politics of letting it expire becomes more fraught. So, like, I'm hoping that we learned our lesson from Bush's temporary tax cuts. So in order to fulfill their goal, their ultimate goal of giving money to wealthy individuals and corporations, they have floated some ideas for generating more revenue, a sort of value-added tax, a border adjustment tax, even a carbon tax have been bandied about, which seems extraordinarily unlikely. I don't know why we even talked about that. But what are the chances that they can agree on any new revenues?
Well, see, the trouble is that you start getting into some of those ideas, and what you find is that some Republicans like them, and some Republicans don't. And the group that may like one particular thing, like a border adjustment tax, may not like some other kind of tax you want to raise. And they're going to need, as we saw with the healthcare reform, they're really going to need unity in order to pass something, especially if they want to pass something big. You know, tax reform, really comprehensive tax reform, usually only happens around once in a generation. And the reason is that it's really complicated. It's just as complicated as healthcare. And you may remember President Trump said nobody knew how complicated healthcare could be. Tax reform is just as complicated. And the trouble is that so many people and so many powerful interests have an interest in all those provisions. You know, loopholes and special tax breaks, they don't come from nowhere. They come because somebody who had the power to dictate it got that provision into the tax code. And so if you're going to just toss the whole thing out, you're going to have all of the kind of special interests and Wall Street and manufacturers and powerful corporations and interest groups descending on Capitol Hill like locusts. And it's going to be really hard to satisfy them all. And so, you know, sometimes Republicans will say, well, we'll lower the rates, but we'll get rid of all the loopholes. You know, that sounds perfectly reasonable until you realize that all of those loopholes, each one has its own defenders. And there are going to be divisions within the Republican Party about some provisions and other provisions. And the question is, can you balance out all those interests and get a final bill that everybody in the GOP can support? It's theoretically possible, but in the past, tax reform has taken years of negotiation. And, you know, they're talking about doing it all in a few months. That is just never going to happen. It's not possible. It's too complicated. There are too many different interests pulling in different directions. They can't get their party unified around it. So I think what may happen is that they'll be confronted with a situation where they start these negotiations, it gets really hard, they can't get agreement, and then they say, you know, we need to pass something. We promised that we were going to pass something. We failed on healthcare. Our base is really unhappy. What can we do? Well, they can default back to the thing that they can't all agree on, and that is cut some taxes for the wealthy, and corporations, and then basically call it a day and declare victory. I think that there's a strong possibility that that's what they're gonna end up doing. This has been referred to in some quarters as the candy option, where you just get the candy and you don't worry about, you know, all the difficult stuff like making it all add up. You know, that may be where they end up, because that's the thing that moderate Republicans and conservative Republicans can agree on. They all want to cut taxes for the wealthy and corporations. So
yeah,
they can just do that and leave it there.
Did you catch the op-ed in the New York Times by Steve Forbes, Larry Kudlow, Arthur Laffer, and Stephen Moore, the kind of the GOP's leading tax grifters or experts?
Yeah, it's sort of the supply-side all-star team. It's the 1927 Yankees of trickle-down economics.
It was just as you described it. They wrote that Republicans shouldn't make things so complex. They shouldn't do a big reform push trying to flatten the tax base. They should keep it simple by just cutting taxes for individuals and corporations. And also, they should fold infrastructure into the bill to win over Democrats. You know, keeping it simple. It was notably incoherent. So, okay, if everyone agrees that they like candy, then what's the problem with that, Paul?
Well, first of all, that would increase deficit greatly. So they would only be able to do it for 10 years. But, you know, that's not the end of the world for them. It's better than nothing. But it will explode the deficit. The other problem, I think, is sort of over the medium and long term, is that they make extravagant promises for this. Republicans firmly believe, or at least say they believe, that if you tweak the tax code, like if you make some cuts at the top end and if you give corporations a break, it will produce an explosion of economic growth and prosperity for all. This is something that they always say. And the inverse, of course, when Democrats want to raise some taxes, they say that will destroy the economy and plunge us into a recession. Now, it never actually happens. We've seen this over and over and over again. You know, when Bill Clinton was going to raise taxes in 1993, Newt Gingrich told everybody that the phrase they had to use to describe it was job-killing recession. It would cause a job-killing recession. And of course, then we had 8 years of extraordinary economic growth, something like 23 million new jobs created. It's not that the tax increases necessarily caused that, but they didn't create the recession that Republicans said they would. Then George W. Bush gets elected in 2000, and they say, oh, if we just cut taxes, it will be fantastic. You'll never believe how great the economy will be. And he did. He cut taxes. And then what happened? Well, you know, we had anemic growth for 8 years, culminating in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression.
And the worst job creation record of any president in, I don't remember how long, but for decades and decades.
Yeah. And when some taxes were raised under Barack Obama, they said the same thing. And, you know, he ended up seeing 16 million jobs created since the trough of the recession. And so they always say that this will happen, that if you just tweak the tax code in the right direction, then that will change everyone's behavior and it will transform the economy. But it never actually happens. And so I think that, for them, it's more really a moral question than anything else. If it actually produced those results, they would be pleased as punch. But even if it doesn't, for them, the idea that you could reduce the tax burden on wealthy people, job creators, the successful, and on corporations, that is a moral good, whether it produces any kind of practical positive impact or not.
Well, there's another aspect to this, which is that, you know, the American Health Care Act, the HCA, the replacement bill, polled, I think it was approved, viewed favorably by 17% of the public. So here you have a candy option that the CBO would score, and they'd find that it blows a massive hole in the deficit, in the budget, drives deficits through the roof, because, as you said, cutting taxes doesn't, in fact, unleash the magic growth fairies. And doing so would fit perfectly into Democrats' messaging and public opinion, right? Because it'd be a big giveaway to the wealthy financed by deficit spending. And as you note in your piece for the Plumline, Americans' number one concern about taxes is that the wealthy don't pay their fair share. So that spells rough politics from both the left and the right, although I think the right has shown a great tolerance for deficit spending under Republican presidents. Paul, how do you think Trump's refusal to release his tax returns will impact or might impact this debate as we move ahead?
Well, you know, I have been surprised at how persistent that issue has been, actually. You know, Trump made a calculation, basically, when he decided he wasn't going to release them. The calculation was that whatever kind of hit he would take for not releasing them would not be as bad as what would happen to him if people actually saw what was in his tax return.
Right.
So I assume he knew that he was going to get criticized, and he probably figured, you know, okay, so I'll take the hit for a while, and then eventually people will just lose interest and we'll move on, and that's a lot better than what would happen if people actually saw what's in them. But what ended up happening was that people didn't really move on. It's not that it's been an issue every day since then, but, you know, you had thousands and thousands of people all over the country actually marching on tax day on April 15th to see his taxes. And now you're seeing Republicans, even some, not a huge number, but more and more all the time, are coming out and saying, yes, Trump ought to show us his tax returns. And I think that it's because it's a really difficult question for them to answer. You know, if you're a Republican congressman and you actually get confronted by your constituents and they say, do you think Trump should release his tax returns? Are you going to say no? It's utterly indefensible. And so, you know, this issue is not going to go away. And it enables Democrats to frame it in a way that's very kind of concrete and personal. And it also gives the media a hook to talk about it, too, because the media love talking about the president. They love taking abstract issues and personalizing them. And so the idea that Republicans are about to pass some kind of bill that is going to help the wealthy in some way, and we don't know exactly how much it's going to help Donald Trump himself, that's something that Democrats can hammer on over and over and over. And you're already seeing that. People like Chuck Schumer are saying, we're not going to allow any tax bill to get through until we see how much it's going to help the president. So it's a real handy way for Democrats to take that issue and make it vivid. And, you know, given how how the polls all show people want to see his returns. You've got people protesting. It seems like it's something that it's they're not going to let go of, and people are going to keep talking about it.
Folks, check out Paul's piece at the Washington Post. It's called "Why Trump's Tax Returns Will Keep Causing Republicans Headaches." And Paul notes that, you know, come 2018, if Democrats can manage to take the House, you're going to have a very different kind of situation in Congress. He writes, and I quote, "Every Democrat would want to get into the act. Don't be surprised if the chair of the Subcommittee on Industrial Adhesives and Postnasal Drip decided there was an urgent need to see those returns pursuant to their investigation into, well, whatever." And that, folks, is why Paul gets the big bucks.
But it's true. You know, if you think about if Democrats can take the House, which is more likely than the Senate, but either one, then all of a sudden, they're the chairman of those committees, and they have subpoena power.
Yeah.
There's actually a law from 1924 that says that the chair of either of the tax writing committees in either house has the ability to just demand from the IRS any American's tax returns. They can look at yours, they can look at mine, and they can look at Donald Trump's.
Republicans voted down an effort to do just that.
Yes.
Yes.
And so, but the chair has the ability to do it, so he can ask for it, and then it would probably end up leaking. And there would be other committee chairs and other committees who would, you know, they'll be subpoenaing the Trump administration on a lot of things. But this is certainly something that they'll ask for. And, you know, what would happen? Well, Trump would probably sue to quash the subpoena. It would end up going to the Supreme Court. He might win, he might lose. But the chances that we'd actually end up getting to see them would be pretty high. And who knows what kind of other investigation that might then unleash.
Yeah. And I mean, as you say, that would be just one area of inquiry for a Democratic Congress that had investigative powers, that had the subpoena power. You know, we could talk about the emoluments clause as well. Paul, I believe we're out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
My pleasure.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Ben Adler. Ben is a journalist who's written for The Times and Washington Post. He used to be with Grist. He's written for pretty much all of the lefty and center-left rags. And I actually wanted to have him on to interrogate him in November about his broadside against ranch dressing in The Washington Post. But the election happened, so we'll have to delay that for another day and satisfy ourselves talking about a more weighty issue. Ben Adler, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Josh.
You ranch dressing hating writer.
I'll defend that anytime.
A few weeks back, Ben wrote a piece for the Washington Post titled "Trump Wants to Roll Back Progress Against Climate Change. He's Going to Fail." Listeners can Google it or find it at WashingtonPost.com. So Donald Trump, as we know, is an extravagant climate change denier. He said the whole thing is kind of like a Chinese hoax designed to give them an economic leg up. He appointed a guy who repeatedly sued the EPA to block regulations to head that agency. So I think that I'm not alone. A lot of progressives are worried that a president who came to power with a minority vote will in fact undermine the entire effort to contain climate change. The thrust of your piece is that we can't just concede that that's a certainty at this point, and that it's not as easy to undo what has been done, the positive steps that have been done, as Trump, I think, would probably might have believed during the campaign. Last month, Miguel Arias Cañete, the EU's climate action commissioner, he lamented Trump's early moves, and then he added, and I'm going to quote, "The continued leadership of the EU, China, and many other major economies is now more important than ever. When it comes to climate and the global clean energy transition, there cannot be vacuums. There can only be drivers, and we are committed to driving this agenda forward." That sentiment seems central to your argument, right?
The headline is a bit of a overstatement, right? Writers don't write headlines. The argument is actually more nuanced. It's not that he will utterly fail to roll back progress against climate change. He will roll it back to some extent, but what he cannot do is single-handedly guarantee that we will suffer catastrophic climate change. This isn't like flipping a light switch, right? It's more of a continuum. But the trigger point at which certain terrible feedback loops kick in, and warming could run out of control, even if there were no further emissions beyond that point, is generally considered to be around 2 degrees Celsius of warming over pre-industrial average temperatures. We're already at 0.9 Celsius, right?
Yes.
So, and we have baked in because there's a lag between emissions and warming. We've already baked in up to about 1.5. Now, that gives us imperative to rapidly decrease emissions down to the point of zero or near zero within the next few decades to stay below 2 degrees. We may fail to do that, but in fact, we're already on a path to fail to do that. The Paris Agreement, if every country meets its obligations under Paris, will still be well over 2 degrees
yes.
Celsius of warming by the end of the century. So, you know, there's a great deal more progress needs to be made, and Trump is going to take us in the wrong direction. This is all true. What isn't true is that, you know, to pull the inside straight, we need to stay below 2 degrees. Trump can't single-handedly make that impossible. The Paris Agreement remains in effect. So you have the framework for countries, the most important thing, which is the framework for countries cooperating to bring down their emissions, remains in place. And the other crucial thing about Paris is that the next round of negotiations, at which time countries must come together and pledge further, steeper, more rapid emissions reductions, it happens in 2020. Trump will still be president, but it happens in the fall. It always happens after the late November, early December. So if President Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker or whomever, president-elect, has been elected,
yes,
and
if he's a lame duck,
isn't necessarily making those. Yeah, if he's a lame duck, I don't think Europe and Japan and Australia and Canada and all the other China, you know, Indian, Indonesian, Brazil, and all those countries are going to say, "Oh well, the U.S. isn't going to cooperate with us. There's no point in reducing emissions further." I think one, they have their own reasons, their own internal political needs to do that. Two, You know, like President-elect Cory Booker will say, like, I hope everyone makes really steep pledges. When I take office, the U.S. will ramp up its ambition. So
yes.
An enormous amount does hinge on 2020, but it's not the case that if in one term, Trump can simply guarantee that we blow through two degrees.
As I read that quote, it's the point that you make in your piece that this is a global problem and not a U.S.-centric solution. China is a huge emitter. India, these rapidly industrialized countries with very large populations. And they have their own, as you say, internal politics. China is investing massive amounts in wind and solar, right? In part because their air is unbreathable.
Exactly. If you've been to Beijing or if you've been to Delhi, you've seen what the smog is like in those countries. It's 10 times safe levels. It's like nothing you've ever seen in the United States. It's affecting people's health. It's affecting their quality of life. It's going to be a drag, therefore, on their economies, already is probably. And so those countries have their own incentive to switch. And this is driven largely by coal, right? They're burning a lot of coal. Coal creates smog as well as carbon pollution. So they have their own incentive to switch to cleaner fuels, and they don't have a huge reservoir of natural gas, which does also create climate pollution, burns cleanly. So the temptation that we have in this country is just switch to natural gas and we have clean air, but we still are creating climate pollution. They don't even really have that option quite as much. So they have to switch more to renewables if they
want to.
Yeah. So they are doing that. And then they also, you know, they have dirty cars, and then there's, you know, rapidly getting more cars as more and more people can afford them. But again, you're getting really bad air quality in the major cities. You know, it's funny, people always talk about Beijing. Beijing isn't even the worst air quality in China. It's like ninth worst or something. There's a whole bunch of cities that, like, you know, I've never heard of with 10 million people that are heavily industrial and have terrible, terrible air quality. So they're rapidly investing in making this change. And then the other thing is, these are climate vulnerable nations. I mean, China's population is heavily concentrated on the coast. India is obviously very, very hot, and extreme heat waves, you know, pose a serious threat in India. So, you know, and they, nor does India want like a wave of climate refugees from Bangladesh, which is like the most climate vulnerable country and is right next door and all that. So it's you know, they have their own reasons for wanting to avert climate change too, not just switching to clean energy to improve their air quality. So they're you know, investing heavily in doing that.
So let me ask you this, and maybe I should take a step back just for listeners who don't pay close attention to this thing. The Paris Agreement does not, as Ben said, get us to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And the idea, central to the agreement, is this ratchet effect. The countries will meet every 5 years, and they will step up their commitments, hopefully step up their commitments to climate change, to fighting emissions, to decreasing emissions. So, Ben, let me ask you this. Part of putting together the Paris Agreement was this whole tension between developed countries and these rapidly developing large population countries, climate vulnerable, smaller countries. There was all these tensions, and there was the idea of, if you don't reduce your emissions, I'm not going to reduce mine. Is it the case that if we fail because of Donald Trump to meet our commitments to the climate deal, we can't assume that China and India are going to follow suit because they have their own incentives?
Exactly. There was a time as recently as, I don't know, 5 years ago or circa 2009 in Copenhagen, where the large developing countries were really of the opinion that the burden for – it was completely unfair for rich countries like the U.S. and Europe to say, we got rich with our industrialization that required huge amounts of energy. And now we drive everywhere and we consume all this electricity and air conditioning, you know, and we want to cut you off because global warming. And they were just like, this is like unfair. And so you have to do all the emissions cutting, not us. That's not the dynamic anymore, particularly with China. China is now the world's largest emitter. So the simple mathematical reality is that they have to reduce emissions if they're going to avert, if the world is going to avert catastrophic climate change. And China has, because of these issues with air quality, because it has a lot more money now, it continues getting richer every year, it has more money to throw at renewable deployment of its own. They and because they have, you know, begun to see some of the risks. I mean, rising sea levels would be, you know, could swamp Shanghai, right? So, like, they have pivoted pretty dramatically in the last few years. Part of it also has to do with the changing economics, and that's affecting, of course, our emissions trajectory here in the U.S. too. Renewables keep getting cheaper.
Yes.
They're much cheaper than they were in 2009. So it's much more viable for countries like China and India to say, you know what, we are going to go solar. It's not going to do us any harm. It's not going to prevent us from industrializing.
Right.
So
right.
So they're making those shifts. China more so than India. India is much more recalcitrant than China because India is in a position where their emissions are much lower than China. And what everyone's wringing their hands about is India has this huge population, and if they India's emissions are much lower because they're less wealthy. And the fear with India is that if they, you know, undergo the transformation that China has in recent decades, that you'll see this explosion of emissions in India. So that's a very complicated problem still. But it is not the case. But India's position is not as it might have been, I don't know, 10 years ago or something. Like, this is all someone else's problem to deal with. I mean, they're all for solar. They just are trying to balance that with a need to lift hundreds of millions of people out of poverty and get them electricity. But in China's already gone a long way on that, and they're much moving much more quickly towards emissions reductions, regardless of what we do.
Let me ask you this. Modi is a very, very conservative leader. Does he accept the scientific consensus on climate change, you know?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I mean, he is in some ways a kind of Trumpian figure, right?
He's yes, he is.
He's a nationalist,
yes.
Right? He's a Islamophobe. He's a nasty piece of work in many ways. But I believe he has a background in science, like engineering. And in any case, he certainly doesn't question the science of climate change.
Yeah, we had Michael Mann on the show, and he pointed out that it's not really that denying climate change is a conservative thing. It's an American conservative thing. And
That's exactly right.
If you talk to right-wingers in other countries, they're like, yeah, it's the science. It is what it is. So, okay, that's the international picture. By the way, let me just say, if you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Ben Adler about his piece in the Washington Post saying that, you know, Trump may not be able to destroy the earth in 4 short years. So on the domestic side, you write, and I quote, "It's unclear whether Trump will be able to make much domestic progress on his rollback anyway." And you say that the law is not on his side. Can you unpack that part for us?
Yeah, sure. I mean, part of, you know, so you were talking about, well, what if the U.S. doesn't meet its obligations under Paris? You know, how much does that deflate enthusiasm among other countries to meet their obligations? And you know, as we discussed, it's not as bad as it used to be in terms of the effect that would have. But there's also the possibility that we won't fail to meet our obligations under Paris, not because Trump wouldn't like to fail to meet them. He would. But because the president really doesn't single-handedly control the emissions trajectory. The emissions trajectory reflects a set of decisions by virtually everyone in this country, right? I mean, all down to the level of like consumer decisions. But at the you know, sort of macro level, energy utilities and the bodies that regulate them, which are public utility commissions and a little more indirectly state legislatures, decide whether the utility is going to burn coal, natural gas, or use a renewable, cleaner source, whether it's hydro, nuclear, wind, or solar. Wind and solar are getting much cheaper. And you have utilities, and gas has gotten much cheaper. And gas is bad for the climate, but less so than coal, basically. So you have switching at the utility level, sometimes mandated by a progressive state government, state legislature, they're never going to open new coal plants. I mean, they're still using the ones that they have and very gradually phasing them out, but they're switching and the emissions trajectory is going downward for that reason, number one. Number two, and this is still really a blip, but it's growing it's a tiny fraction, but it's growing rapidly. You have people doing home solar, right? And so they're drawing less electricity from the grid, even in states where the mix of electricity generation is dirtier. But if they put a solar panel on their roof and provide enough electricity for their home, that's that much coal that isn't being burned. You also have electricity usage has been flat in recent years, even though you've got growing population, growing economy. That's because we have gains in efficiency. Of course, Trump's trying to unwind that.
Right.
He wants to get rid of Energy Star. So, you know, if you had a Trumpian government indefinitely, over the long haul, you'd see him able to increase emissions through all these different things that he's doing. But over the course of 4 years, with the powers at his disposal, which do not include the power to tell an energy utility that's regulated at the state level whether it's going to have a coal plant or a gas plant or a solar plant, he's not going to be able to necessarily alter the emissions trajectory that much. And we probably, if I had to, place a bet, I'd say we're going to miss our Paris target, but kind of narrowly. Like, it's okay. Not going to be such a, if you look at probabilities, there's, non-trivial chance we'll make it. And then there's a significant chance we'll miss it, but not necessarily by a wide mile, because emissions will continue to decline, just not as much as maybe they would have under a Clinton administration.
You know, there was this telling story, I don't know if you caught this, about what you're talking about as far as the market forces at work. Last week, it was reported that the Kentucky Coal Museum switched over to solar power to save money. And they said, we're doing this to save money, and it's still coal country, they said, because that's culturally the case. But even an institution that dedicated to coal found that there were cost savings that they couldn't resist. And I kind of want to ask you this, based on that dynamic. The Obama administration sunk, tens of billions of dollars in seed money into renewables. Is that something that can't be undone? Once you've made those investments in the private sector, getting companies closer to market with new innovations, is it like an example of good government creating a virtuous cycle of investment that can't necessarily be undone by a science-denying crackpot in the White House?
Yes, that's exactly right. Mike Grunwald is on about this a lot. He wrote a book about the
New Deal
stimulus. Yeah, he's in Politico magazine, and my former Grist colleague Dave Roberts, who's now at Vox.com. This is before I was back at the time of the stimulus bill. I was doing more general politics and policy for Newsweek, so I am not as well versed in the particulars of the renewable energy investments. But it is certainly true that what happened in that law is that there was a lot of money put into kickstarting technological advance around renewable energy production, and that helped to accelerate the speed at which prices are coming down in solar and wind. Yes, exactly. That can't be undone, right? Prices have now dropped to the point where a new kilowatt of power from wind or solar can actually be cheaper than a new kilowatt from coal. So you're not going to see anyone opening a new coal plant if they could get it more cheaply from renewables or gas. The tricky thing is that utilities build power plants that are meant to last like 50 years, right? So it is not cheaper to decommission a coal plant in the middle of its life cycle and put it in and replace it with solar, right? So you have this very long lag between the point at which utilities start going to renewables and the point at which they have become exclusively renewable reliant. And then there are other technological issues that still need to be addressed in terms of storage. It is still more expensive to store power from, you know, like the sun is shining and you have too much electricity being generated and you have to have an economical way to store it for when it's cloudy. If you're going to have a utility that depends entirely on renewables as opposed to, you know, having a mix where it's part renewable and part coal or gas that provides what's called base load power generation. And it would be great if we had a Congress that would appropriate and a president who would sign into law a bill investing in, you know, accelerating the speed at which prices of storage come down, because they are coming down. And that would help enormously. And that would also enable more people to go off the grid and have the solar panel on their roof and then just store the power in a, like, you know, battery in their garage or something. But unfortunately, you know, we don't have that at the moment. But those past advances can't be undone.
Maybe coming soon from Tesla. They got the new roof tiles that are beautiful and look very unobtrusive. I put myself on a waiting list to get some information on that when they're available. Ben Adler, I believe we're out of time. I just, folks, Ben made one other point that I didn't have time to cover. The states, blue states, big blue states like New York and California are really stepping up their own emissions reductions as part of a greater scheme to compensate for what's going on in Washington. You should really check out Ben's piece. It's at the Washington Post. It's titled, again, Trump wants to roll back progress against climate change. He's going to fail. Ben, thank you so much for joining me this week. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Josh. It was my pleasure.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back. Back to the show. We're staying on climate change for another segment here. Joining us now is Kendra Pierre Lewis, who is a staff writer for Popular Science, which, by the way, must be an awesome job. Kendra wrote a piece this week titled, As Sea Levels Rise, Where Will All the People Go? And listeners can Google it or check it out at popsci.com. That's popsci.com. Kendra, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Hi, thanks, Josh, so much for having me.
Thank you so much for taking the time. So this piece that you wrote looked at a new study that was published in the journal Nature Climate Change. To begin with, why don't you tell us a little bit about who conducted it and what they hope to find?
Sure. So it was an academic researcher. I'm actually blanking on what institution he's affiliated, University of Georgia, I believe. And he was... he had done an earlier study sort of looking at where along the coast people will be forced to move because of sea level rise. And this is sort of a follow-up study where he was looking to see where they would be most likely to go. Because as people migrate, they're going to put additional pressures on the places they migrate to.
The study was by Mather Howard at the University of Georgia. He's a geographer, actually, which is kind of interesting. So how did Howard go about divining where people might move? I mean, you never know, right?
Sure. So actually, there are databases that Americans, when we move in very predictable ways. So I don't know if you've done any traveling, but for example, I lived in Vermont for a while, and whenever people talk about Portland, they're not talking about Oregon, they're talking about Maine. Right. And so they're more likely to move from Vermont to Portland, Maine than they are to move from Vermont to Portland, Oregon. And so there are pretty robust databases that sort of categorize where people have a tendency to move toward to. And so he used that information overlaid with the places that people are most likely to move from to see where people are very likely to go.
I went to college in Bennington, Vermont. Where did you live?
I lived in Guilford.
Nice. It's a beautiful little state. It's small, rural, but really pretty, huh?
Yeah, really pretty.
Yeah. So I think when we think about people being displaced by climate change, and maybe this isn't true of everybody, but I think most people's minds go to islands in the South Pacific being swamped. You think of low-lying coastal areas, and what this study is saying that it will have a kind of secondary effect as people inland have to deal with this significant migration of people from those areas. So it's not like if we're on high ground, we can say this won't affect us. Now, right. You mentioned that he did an earlier study. Mm-hmm. It was also conducted by Hauer. It estimated that as many as 13 million Americans might be displaced by the end of the century if sea levels rise by 6 feet. Isn't that rise almost like a worst-case scenario, though?
So that rise is a business-as-usual scenario. So
that is? Okay.
Yeah, it's the expectation that we're not going to do anything to mitigate climate change. It's if we continue on our current trajectory.
And, I mean, is that likely? I mean, we see the segment before you was about the efforts to combat global emissions being something that is not so easy to undo even when there's a major political change in Washington.
Right. So it's not necessarily so easy to undo, but everyone knows. So one of the biggest differences that happened, I guess, with the transition is a recognition that what President Obama laid down didn't actually go far enough. It was sort of like the groundwork. Hillary Clinton's would have been even more aggressive. Even if what we're doing now we don't undo, it actually isn't significant enough to stop climate change. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does. I mean, the Paris Accord was supposed to have this ratchet effect where right. countries had to increase their commitments. We touched on that in the last segment. Now, one thing that we've learned during the negotiations leading up to Paris is that rising sea levels are not expected to affect people equally. And a lot of this has to do with the resources available exactly. for mitigation, right? Because have you ever been to Amsterdam?
I actually have been to Amsterdam. So there are places like Miami that we probably do not have enough resources to deal with Miami under a business as usual situation. Miami will probably be lost. There just isn't the technology and the capability to fix that situation. New York, we probably won't lose. We might lose parts of New York, so like lower Manhattan. But then there's also the question of when you're mitigating for climate change, are you creating unintended effects? So there is a plan, for example, that was floated to build kind of like a wall around New York City so that as hurricanes or sea level rose, you could sort of divert the water, but you would be diverting that water to coastal New Jersey. So they would have much more severe weather events. So that's the other kind of important aspect is that anything we do to try to balance out these negative effects are not a zero-sum game. There are going to be winners and losers. And in the study that he profiled, for example, one of the things that if you look at it, you can see that a lot of the people who are going to be migrating are going to be migrating from the Southeast. And that's because there are a lot of people in the Southeast live along the coast, but also because a lot of the people who live in the Southeast are relatively poor. These are states that have not committed a ton of money for infrastructure and for design. And so they're not going to be able to mitigate, like even under current situations, they're not able to mitigate sort of weather events, under a worst case or a business as usual scenario, you can't necessarily expect them to do better all of a sudden.
It's really frightening. You write, and I quote, "The problem won't be as simple as girding inland cities to support an influx of new residents either. Plenty of folks will be unwilling or unable to leave their slowly flooding regions." I lived in Florida for a while. I've lived in several places. I lived in Florida for a while, and I remember there was, and I don't remember which hurricane it was. There was this hurricane coming, and the warnings were very dire, but there was a significant chunk of the population that refused to evacuate, right? Right. What happens to those people? Do they just, I don't know, get washed away?
So I spoke to a disaster expert who had done some work under Hurricane Katrina, not in New Orleans, but in the broader like Gulf Coast region. And there is, they do something down there, which is kind of like a last pass, where they knock on the door. And if you refuse to evacuate, they make you write your social security number on your body in Sharpie so that they can at least identify the body when it's back.
Oh, my goodness. What? I'm sorry to laugh. I mean, that's so not funny, but...
So not funny, but yeah. So, I mean, if you... This isn't a climate-related disaster, but do you know the story of Centralia, Pennsylvania?
No, I don't.
So, like, in the 1950s, there was an underground coal seam fire that started there, and it's slowly been burning underneath this town ever since then. In the early... Like, it's a ghost town at this point. In the early 2000s, they lost their post office. They're officially they're no longer an incorporated town. And there's still a fire. Like if you go to Centralia, you can see the ground steaming, but people still live there. They've refused to evacuate.
Wow. People are mysterious sometimes in that way. Okay. So let's talk briefly about the potential for social upheaval. In your piece, you talked about another aspect of the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And in Hurricane Katrina, after Hurricane Katrina, we got a sort of natural experiment about the effects of a large-scale internal displacement in the United States. Tell us a little bit about that angle.
So, So after Hurricane Katrina, a large number of people migrated out of the Gulf Coast and into Texas, specifically into Houston. And I think a little over 100,000 of them ultimately became permanent residents. But to this day, there's still some anti-Gulf Coast sentiment or, you know, towards those people who migrated over. I think 2 years ago, a state senator used an ethnic slur for Cajuns in the state courthouse or in the state house. And there was, you know, there was a lot of bias. People would refuse to give them jobs. They were blamed for crime waves that to this day, it's unclear whether or not they caused. And the other thing that I think is really helpful to recognize is that where people migrate to is kind of directly proportional to their social support. So people who have a ton of like social capital, and that's not just money. One of the things that happened, and one of the reasons, for example, during Hurricane Katrina, why a lot of people chose not to evacuate, is they had nowhere to go. They'd grown up in it like the lower ninth ward, and literally everyone they knew in the world was in the lower ninth ward. So they couldn't afford to evacuate, and they couldn't afford a hotel room somewhere else.
Right, right. And that group that migrated was disproportionately African American and disproportionately poor. So you had multiple different factors that caused often bigoted responses, right? So it wasn't just that they were from outside Houston.
Yeah, right. It wasn't just that they were from outside Houston. But at the same time, when you look at within New Orleans, you also found people who banded together to keep the outsiders from other neighborhoods out of their dry neighborhoods within New Orleans.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, that is an ugly aspect of human nature. This is all scary stuff. Kendra Pierre-Lewis, I believe we're about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Folks, again, the piece is titled "As Sea Levels Rise, Where Will All the People Go?" And you can check it out at popside.com. I'd also like to thank Paul Waldman and Ben Adler. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I would like to thank the good people at Hullabaloo and Crooks and Liars. and the smirking chump, smirking chimp, sorry, for letting me host the show at their respective joints. And of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in this week. Have a terrific week.